Welcome to the deep dive. You know, this is where we take a whole stack of sources, articles, research, maybe some of our own scribbled notes, and we really try to boil it all down.
Get to the core of it.
Exactly. We want to find those crucial nuggets of knowledge, the key insights. The goal is simple. Give you the shortcut to being genuinely well-informed.
Hopefully with a few surprising facts thrown in.
Right, and maybe just enough humor to keep things moving. Today, we're unpacking something that, well, it shapes almost everything we do daily.
How we connect.
How we connect to the world. I mean, think about it, streaming your favorite shows, that super fast internet you need for working from home now. It's all about staying connected.
Absolutely essential.
And right in the middle of this constant evolution, making some pretty serious waves, is one of the biggest players out there, Charter Communications, Inc. You probably know them as CHTR on the stock market.
A giant in the space, for sure.
So our mission today is really to give you a full picture. We want to understand Charter's strategic position, its financial health, how it's performing operationally.
And all of this within a telecom landscape that's just changing incredibly fast. It's really dynamic right now.
It really is. The big picture, the sort of core thesis of our deep dive today, is that Charter is making a very deliberate and very capital-intensive pivot.
Yeah, moving away from their traditional roots.
Exactly. Moving from that traditional business model towards something they call a converged connectivity framework.
Which really puts their Spectrum Mobile offering front and center as a growth engine.
Right. And if that wasn't, you know, enough change on its own, we're also going to dig into the recently announced merger with Cox Communications, which is, frankly, transformative.
Huge news. Potentially industry reshaping.
Totally. So we're setting the stage here. We're looking at a company that's really at a critical inflection point. It's navigating, well, intense competition, shifting consumer habits.
And those inherent challenges, right? Legacy markets versus brand new tech.
Yeah, it's that classic clash. This is about understanding a giant that's essentially trying to reinvent itself in real time.
It's a fascinating moment to look at the telecom sector and Charter specifically. The forces at play here are huge. They're reshaping not just companies like Charter, but fundamentally how we access and consume information, entertainment, everything.
It really feels like a strategic chess match playing out right now.
Absolutely. High stakes.
Okay, let's dive right into that U.S. telecommunications landscape then, because as you said, it's a sector truly in transformation.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the market dynamics, the growth trajectory, I mean, the U.S. telecom market is undeniably vast. It's essential.
Billions and billions.
Right. It's mature, yes, but it's still showing some modest growth. We're talking estimates of around, what, $459 billion in 2025.
Yeah, and projected to climb towards maybe $550 billion by 2030.
Which sounds big, but the growth rate, the CAGR, is actually pretty modest, like 3.67%.
Right. And what's really intriguing, I think, is how you have these almost contradictory trends happening at the same time.
How so?
Well, you have that overall market growth, but underneath it, there's this intense pressure from commoditization.
Okay, explain that a bit.
So while the U.S. telecom market grows modestly, if you look broader at the global internet services market, which includes broadband, is projected to grow much faster, like an 8.2% CAGR through 2030.
Ah, so connectivity itself is booming globally.
Exactly. But that masks the pressure. Because global telecom service revenue growth is actually slowing way down. We're talking like 2.9% CAGR through 2028.
Which is less than inflation, potentially.
That's the key point. It trails projected inflation. And that points directly to severe commoditization, especially in those core connectivity service broadband basic phone lines.
Meaning it just becomes about price?
Largely, yeah. It forces providers like Charter to constantly innovate, to find new ways to add value, because just selling speed isn't enough to protect your margins anymore.
So if the market's growing overall, but the core services are getting squeezed, what's actually driving the expansion? How are companies like Charter forced to, you know, rethink their value beyond just raw speed?
That's really the crux of it, isn't it? The commoditization happens because, well, competition is heating up, and consumers increasingly see internet speed, once you hit a certain level, as a basic utility, like water or electricity.
Right. Good enough is good enough for many.
Precisely. So providers have to shift focus. The growth drivers are things like the continued rollout of 5G networks. That opens up new possibilities, especially for home internet, with fixed wireless access or FWA. We'll talk more about that.
Okay.
Then there's just our insatiable appetite for data. Think about your own usage. The average monthly data consumption per smartphone, It's projected to hit 12.5 gigabytes in 2024.
Wow, that's a lot of streaming, scrolling video calls.
It adds up fast. And finally, you have significant government investment. That's $65 billion from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the IIJA. A big chunk of that is aimed at closing the digital divide, expanding broadband access.
So those things push the market forward, but also intensify the pressure to stand out somehow.
Exactly. It fuels expansion, but makes the competitive landscape even tougher. Innovate or get left behind, basically.
And innovation is definitely needed because Charter and its peers are grappling with what we're calling the triad of disruption.
Good term for it.
Yeah, it's cord cutting, fiber overbuild, and that 5G fixed wireless access you just mentioned. Let's start with cord cutting, the secular decline of traditional video.
Mm-hmm. The slow bleed that became a hemorrhage.
Right. This isn't just a minor trend anymore. It's a deep, long-term shift, and it's still accelerating. The numbers are pretty stark. U.S. households with cable TV peaked at maybe 105 million back in 2010.
Feels like a lifetime ago.
Doesn't it? Now it's estimated to be around 68.7 million in 2025. That pushes the penetration rate way down from like 88% to now under half of households.
Wow, below 50%. That's huge.
And the projections. By 2026, they expect cord-cutting households, maybe 80.7 million, to significantly outnumber traditional pay TV homes, which could be down to about 54.3 million.
And the main reason is pretty clear, right? It's the cost.
Overwhelmingly, over 86% of consumers who cut the cord point to the high price of those traditional cable bundles.
And meanwhile, you've got this explosion of streaming services, lower cost, more flexible, tons of content. Mm. They just offer a really compelling alternative.
It really hit a tipping point, didn't it? July 2022, I think, was when streaming viewership actually overtook cable TV viewership for the first time.
It's a real watershed moment. It kind of cemented the new media hierarchy.
So for a company like Charter, this is obviously a massive deal. They've been seeing consistent high single-digit annual declines in cable subs.
And their video revenue took a big hit recently, right?
Yeah, Q2 2025, down 9.9% year over year. So their strategy had to change fundamentally. They've started doing these deals.
They're bundling in the streamers?
Exactly. Bundling Hulu, Disney Plus, often at no extra cost, into their Spectrum TV packages. It's a major strategic pivot.
The CEO, Chris Winfrey, has been pretty explicit about this.
He has. He said the goal isn't for video to be the main profit driver anymore. It's about transforming video into a, quote, competitive advantage for our internet and mobile sales.
So video becomes a tool.
A strategic tool for customer retention, basically. A defensive moat to protect that high-margin broadband business.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting, right? This evolution of video from profit center to essentially a strategic loss leader, maybe. Hmm. What's the core insight here for how companies adapt and maybe for us as consumers?
Yeah, what does it really mean going forward?
I think the core insight is the death of the standalone high-margin video business as we knew it. For providers like Charter, it's now about video as a retention mechanism.
Keep them hooked on the bundle.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
For us, the consumers, it means our entertainment choices are increasingly tied to our connectivity provider, not just a separate bill we pay. Your broadband provider might be your gateway to Disney Plus or Hulu now.
So fewer separate bills, maybe, but more reliance on that single provider.
Potentially. And for the companies, it's a stark lesson. Adapt how you use your legacy assets, make them serve new strategic goals, or you risk losing the entire customer relationship, not just the video piece.
Adapt or become obsolete. Classic business dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's unpack the second disruptive force. The competitive threat from fiber overbuild.
Ah, yes, the speed race.
Right. For years, cable operators like Charter, they kind of had a near monopoly, didn't they, on high-speed internet in the large parts of their territory.
Yeah, in many areas, they were the only game in town for fast speeds.
Well, that era is definitively over. We're seeing aggressive expansion of fiber to the home, FTTH networks.
By the telcos and even some new players entering the market.
And the numbers are significant. By the end of 2024, FTTH is expected to be accessible to nearly 80 million U.S. homes.
Wow, that's over half of all residences.
It's a huge build-out, up from just 60 million homes passed in 2022. And a lot of this is being accelerated by government money, right?
Definitely. Federal and state subsidies are playing a big role, especially that $42.5 billion BEAD program, Broadband Equity Access and Deployment. It heavily prioritizes fiber projects.
And fiber has really captured the sort of premium perception in the market.
Oh, absolutely. It's now the largest broadband segment by revenue, commanding almost 37% market share in 2024.
And people are choosing it when they have the option.
Consistently. Market studies show that where consumers have a choice between fiber and traditional cable, HFC, fiber wins most new subscribers. It's a big driver of churn away from cable.
And the competition is getting denser, too. It's not just one fiber provider anymore in some places.
Right. The percentage of homes with access to two or more competing FTTH providers nearly doubled just between 2022 and 2023. Went from about 4% to 7%.
Okay, so this direct technological challenge, this fiber onslaught, is really the main reason behind Charter's massive spending on network upgrades.
It's the primary impetus, yes, for that multi-billion dollar investment in their network evolution.
Which involves upgrading their existing network, that hybrid fiber coaxial HFC plant, to DIOCSIS 4.0.
Right, the latest cable standard.
And the promise there is multi-gigabit symmetrical speeds, right? Uploads as fast as downloads.
That's the goal, to directly match fiber performance.
Okay, let's unpack this. How critical is it really for Charter to match those fiber speeds, especially the symmetrical part? What are the risks if they lag behind?
It's absolutely critical. In today's market, especially for higher-end users, gamers, people working from home with heavy cloud usage, symmetrical gigabit speeds from fiber are seen as the gold standard.
So it's a marketing disadvantage if you don't have it.
A huge one. If Charter's HFC network can't match that performance, they risk losing their most valuable customers, the ones willing to pay more for premium performance.
And given that Charter is actually losing broadband subscribers right now.
Exactly. This DIOCSIS 4.0 upgrade isn't just a nice to have, it's a fundamental requirement. It's about achieving technological parity to defend their most profitable business segment. It neutralizes that key fiber marketing point.
So it's a defensive necessity, a technological arms race they have to participate in.
They absolutely do. Mm. Without it, the perceived value of their bundle starts to erode significantly against fiber offerings.
Okay, and then there's the third leg of this disruption triad, the rise of 5G fixed wireless access, or FWA.
Yeah, the one that kind of came out of left field for some folks.
Right. Initially, maybe dismissed as niche or just for rural areas where there were no other options, but it has scaled incredibly quickly.
The numbers are surprising. By 2025, FWA reached about 12% penetration among U.S. households.
That's a threefold increase since just 2023.
Yeah, and the subscriber base grew by almost 47% in the last year alone. Mm. We're talking nearly 12 million homes using FWA now.
Wow. And critically, it's not just about being the cheaper option, is it? They seem to be doing well on satisfaction.
That's the really crucial part. It's winning on customer satisfaction. Wow. You look at J.D. Power, the ACSI index. FWA from T-Mobile and Verizon is tying or even beating fiber and cable internet satisfaction scores.
That's remarkable. And it translates to market share gains.
Staggering gains. In 2023, get this, FWA providers added 34 times more net subscribers per quarter than the entire cable industry combined.
34 times. That's a disruption.
That's a clear indicator of its disruptive power, yes. This raises an important question, doesn't it? If FWA is winning on customer satisfaction, what does that tell us about what consumers actually prioritize in their internet service?
Right. Is it always just about the maximum possible speed?
And what are the long-term implications for this battle between wireline and wireless internet?
It definitely challenges that old assumption, the one where wireline networks like cable and fiber just had this unbeatable advantage in speed and reliability.
Mm-hmm. FWA has proven that wireless can be good enough or even great for a lot of people.
And it's introduced a strong third competitor in many markets that used to be basically cable versus telco duopolies.
Absolutely. This added competitive pressure is a primary factor behind those broadband subscriber losses Charter and others are seeing.
Which, again, just reinforces why Charter is pushing that converged mobile broadband bundle so hard. It becomes a key differentiator when you're facing heat from FWA, too.
It absolutely does. That bundle becomes even more crucial. So back to that question about consumer priorities.
Mm.
What do you think the FWA satisfaction scores tell us?
Well, it feels like maybe reliability, ease of setup, customer service, and of course price are becoming just as important, if not more so for many users, than having the absolute bleeding edge multi-gig speed.
I agree. It suggests a shift. For many households, maybe 100, 300, 500 milliamps is perfectly adequate. If FWA can deliver that reliably, with good service and a simple bill, maybe at a lower price point.
It becomes very attractive. It's like realizing you don't need a Ferrari for your daily commute. A reliable, comfortable sedan does the job well and costs less.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And the long-term implication. Wireline providers, especially cable, can't just rely on speed anymore. They have to compete on service, bundling value, customer experience, and they have to get those symmetrical speeds rolled out with DOCSIS 4.0.
Because FWA just lowered the barrier to entry for home internet competition significantly.
Exactly. The wireless carriers are now major players in the home broadband market.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly to the regulatory environment, because that's always a factor in this industry.
Always lurking.
And there was a pretty significant development in January 2025, right? Regarding net neutrality.
Yes. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit made a big ruling. They struck down the FCC's 2024 order, the Safeguarding and Securing the Open Internet order.
And the core issue was the FCC trying to reclassify broadband.
Right. The court said the FCC overstepped its authority by trying to classify broadband internet as a Title II telecommunication service. That would have meant utility-style regulation.
Like old-school phone lines.
Pretty much. So the ruling effectively killed those federal-level net neutrality rules, the ones banning blocking, throttling, or paid fast lanes.
So for Charter, what does that mean in the short term? Is it a positive?
Near term, yes. It's generally seen as a positive for ISPs like Charter. It removes a big regulatory overhang, cuts down on compliance costs.
Gives them more flexibility.
More flexibility in managing their network, and potentially opens the door for new pricing tiers or service offerings. Though they have to be careful about customer backlash, obviously.
But it's not totally settled, right? What about the long term? So what does this all mean for Charter's operational freedom and the future of internet regulation in the U.S.?
Well, that's the tricky part. While the federal rules are gone for now, the whole debate just shifts. It moves to Congress and, crucially, to individual state legislatures.
Ah, so we could end up with a patchwork of different rules.
Exactly. A complex, potentially inefficient patchwork of state-level regulations.
Right.
California already has its own net neutrality law, for instance.
Oh.
So while Charter gets more federal breathing room,
they might face new complexities state by state.
Precisely. Trading one big regulatory challenge for potentially 50 smaller ones.
So with net neutrality sort of off the FCC's front burner for now, what's the main regulatory focus for Charter?
It really shifts to antitrust review of major corporate actions. And the elephant in the room there is the proposed Charter-Cox merger.
How's the outlook for that getting approved?
The general consensus among policy analysts seems to be that it's likely to get regulatory approval.
Why is that?
Because it's primarily a geographic expansion. Charter is moving into Cox markets where they don't currently operate. It's not an in-market consolidation where you're directly reducing consumer choice by buying your direct competitor in the same town.
Okay, that makes sense. Different footprints.
Right. But the FCC still has broad authority to review the deal for public interest benefits. They could still impose conditions on the merger approval.
Conditions related to what?
Could be related to broadband deployment targets, pricing commitments, maybe things related to competition or labor issues. So it's not a complete slam dunk, but the core antitrust hurdle seems lower than it would be for an in-market deal.
Got it.
Okay, let's zoom in on Charter Communications itself now. Do a bit of a corporate and strategic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So just to recap, Charter Communications, Inc., operating as Spectrum, one of the biggest broadband connectivity companies, biggest cable operators in the U.S.
Based in Stamford, Connecticut.
Right. Serving over 31.2 million, actually residential and business customers. That's a huge base.
Massive footprint.
And their main services are pretty straightforward. Spectrum Internet, the flagship broadband, Spectrum TV, the traditional cable, but as we said, evolving with streaming apps.
Spectrum Voice, the landline phone service, which still exists.
Still exists.
Yeah.
Spectrum Mobile, their MVNO mobile virtual network operator using other carriers' networks. And Spectrum Business, serving enterprise customers.
A pretty comprehensive suite.
Now, the person steering the ship, the architect of their current strategy, is President and CEO Christopher Winfrey.
Took the helm in October 2022.
All right, but he's not new to Charter. He was the CFO since 2010, a long tenure.
Yeah, and apparently played a key role in those big acquisitions back in 2016, Time Warner Cable, Bright House Networks.
Those deals really reshaped Charter into the giant it is today. So what's fascinating here is this transition, right? A long-serving CFO moving into the CEO spot, such a clear and, frankly, capital-intensive strategy. How do you think his financial background shapes that approach?
I think it shapes it profoundly. A CFO lives and breathes capital allocation, ROI, balance sheet management. Winfrey understands the numbers behind these huge long-term bets.
So he's not just chasing growth blindly.
Unlikely. He's likely looking very closely at the expected return on invested capital for the network upgrades, the rural expansion, the mobile build-out. He understands the need to manage that significant debt load while making these investments.
It's a calculated risk, then, balancing the spending with the potential long-term payoff.
Exactly. It's a disciplined approach. Even though the spending levels are huge, it's about building a more resilient, more profitable business down the road, even if it means squeezing near-term free cash flow. That financial discipline is probably deeply ingrained.
And his core strategic vision, we mentioned earlier, is this converged connectivity.
Right, moving away from selling individual products.
Yeah, focusing on that seamless integrated bundle, high-speed internet plus mobile. The idea is superior value. Faster speeds, better price overall.
To boost loyalty and cut down on churn.
And this vision requires those big, long-term investments in three key areas as he lays it out.
Network evolution is one. Keep that tech edge.
Rural footprint expansion, find new growth areas.
And that U.S.-based, employee-focused service model. Trying to differentiate on customer experience.
Right. Which brings us neatly to the convergence play itself, yeah. Integrating mobile and broadband.
And Spectrum Mobile really is the centerpiece of their growth story right now.
It really is. It's managed to become the fastest growing mobile provider in the U.S. That's pretty remarkable for what's essentially a cable company.
The recent numbers bear that out. Q2 2025, they added another 500,000 mobile lines.
Bringing the total to 10.9 million lines, that's almost 25% growth year over year. Incredible velocity.
And the strategic importance goes way beyond just the mobile revenue itself, right? Which, by the way, was up nearly 25% year over year.
Right. Its main job is retention.
Primarily, yes. It's a powerful retention tool for that core high-margin internet product. You bundle attractively priced mobile with broadband.
And the customer is less likely to leave for a competitor. It makes the whole package stickier.
Exactly. They've shown data that customers taking the bundle have demonstrably lower churn rates. It works.
And they do this using the MVNO model.
Right. They lease network access from the big guys, historically, Verizon. Now they have a deal with T-Mobile, too, for business customers. Gives them flexibility without having to build a national network from scratch.
It feels like a really smart leveraging of their existing asset, that huge base of broadband customers.
It's a textbook example of leveraging your customer relationship to penetrate a new adjacent market. Really well executed.
And financially, it's hit a turning point.
A very significant one. For years, mobile was a drag on cash flow. You had startup costs, heavy device subsidies.
Giving away phones isn't cheap.
Not at all. But management confirmed recently that the mobile segment, looking at EBITDA minus its own capital expenditures, is now cash flow positive.
Okay, so it's actually contributing cash now, not just customers.
Exactly. That's huge. It establishes mobile as a real tailwind, as they put it, to overall free cash flow growth. It's become a vital second engine for the company.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This journey of Spectrum Mobile from being maybe an unprofitable venture initially to a major cash flow contributor and growth driver. What does that teach us about making these big, long-term strategic investments?
I think it teaches us about strategic patience. They didn't pull the plug when it was losing money initially. They saw the bigger picture, how mobile could protect and enhance their core broadband business.
So the focus wasn't just on mobile's standalone profitability at first?
Right. The primary goal was to make the overall customer relationship more valuable and less prone to churn. The direct profit from mobile was secondary initially. Now it's delivering both.
So sometimes the best investment isn't the one with the quickest direct payoff, but the one that strengthens your core.
Precisely. It's a calculated long-term play, prioritizing the health of the high-margin broadband base. And in Charter's case, that patience seems to be paying off handsomely now.
That foresight seems evident, too, in their big network evolution and rural expansion plans.
Yeah, the spending there is enormous right now.
They're in a peak capital investment cycle. Projected CapEx for 2025 is around $11.5 billion.
That's a huge number, even for a company Charter size.
And they break down that spending into three main buckets, three strategic initiatives that kind of complement each other.
Right. First, there's the big network evolution project.
That's the DOCSIS 4.0 upgrade we talked about. Multi-stage, multi-year, upgrading their existing HFC plant.
Critical for delivering those multi-gig symmetrical speeds, matching fiber, neutralizing that fiber advantage. It's defensive.
Defensive necessity, yeah.
Yeah.
Then second, the rural construction initiative.
This one's more offensive. about growth.
Right. Investing billions to build out over 100,000 miles of new fiber optic lines.
Aiming to reach over 1.7 million homes and businesses, mostly in rural areas, that are currently unserved or underserved.
So entering new markets where maybe there isn't much competition.
Exactly. And often getting government subsidies to help make the economics work, improving the ROI on those builds.
Okay. And the third pillar of spending.
Mobile infrastructure build out. They're actively deploying their own small cells using CBRS Spectrum Citizens broadband radio service.
Why do that if they have the MVNO deals?
It's part of a longer-term plan to become more of a hybrid mobile operator, HMNO. By building their own targeted wireless infrastructure in high-traffic areas, they can offload data traffic from Verizon's or T-Mobile's network onto their own.
Which saves them money.
Significantly improves the long-term mobile economics, yes. It reduces those wholesale payments they make to their MVNO partners. Requires upfront capital, but lowers operating costs down the line.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this three-pronged spending strategy, network evolution, rural build-out, mobile infrastructure, how does it reshape their future?
I think it shows a really balanced approach. Defensive, network evolution to protect the core. Offensive, rural build-out for new growth, and strategic mobile infrastructure for better long-term profitability.
It's playing defense and offense simultaneously.
Exactly. And acknowledging the short-term pain, this period of heavy spending definitely hits near-term free cash flow, but it's presented as a calculated investment.
Laying the groundwork for a more defensible, technologically advanced, and ultimately more profitable company in the long run.
That's the narrative. It's a bet on execution. And if they pull it off, it could fundamentally improve their cost structure and competitive standing for years.
All right, let's dive deeper into the numbers. The operational and financial performance from Q2 2025.
Okay, the recent results.
Looking at subscriber dynamics first, this really shows that strategic shift in action, internet. Well, they reported a net loss of 117,000 residential and small business internet customers.
Which sounds bad, but how does it compare?
It's actually better than the 149,000 they lost in Q2 of 2024, but there's a caveat.
Always a caveat.
Last year's number was impacted by about 50,000 disconnects when the government's affordable connectivity program, the ACP subsidies, ended for many.
Ah, so if you adjust for that, the underlying loss trend might be similar or even slightly worse.
It suggests the underlying challenge of subscriber losses in the core broadband segment is still very much present. They ended the quarter with 29.9 million internet customers. Still huge, but the trend is concerning.
Okay, but what about mobile? That's the bright spot.
Definitely the standout performer. Added another 500,000 Spectrum mobile lines in Q2.
Bringing the total to nearly 11 million.
10.9 million, yeah. It was slightly below the 557,000 they added the year before, but still represents that strong nearly 24% year-over-year growth. The momentum is clearly there.
Sustained high-velocity growth in mobile.
And then video. This was actually a surprise.
Better than expected.
Way better. They only lost 80,000 total video customers. Compare that to losing 408,000 in the same quarter last year.
Oh, that's a dramatic improvement. A five-fold improvement. What drove that?
Management pointed to those new simplified pricing and packaging strategies they rolled out late last year, and also the early benefits from integrating streaming apps directly into the bundle.
So the strategy of making video a retention tool seems to be working, or at least slowing the bleeding significantly.
It appears to be stemming the losses quite effectively, yes. So synthesizing these numbers, broadband under pressure, mobile driving growth, video stabilizing. So what does this all mean for their overall customer relationships? Are they just swapping, you know, a high margin broadband video customer for a lower margin mobile customer, or is this building something sustainable?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's definitely not just swapping. It's a clear strategic realignment. Mobile is unequivocally the engine for customer relationship growth now. Video is transitioning from a liability into, hopefully, a stable part of the bundle.
But the core broadband is still leaking.
Right. The crucial question remains, can that mobile momentum and video stability actually be leveraged to reverse the negative trend in broadband? Can the Spectrum One bundle ultimately win back or stop losing those core internet subs?
That's the key to sustainable, profitable growth, not just customer growth.
Exactly. That's the litmus test for the whole strategy.
Okay, shifting to the financials, revenue, profitability, and margins. Q2 consolidated results, that kind of reflected these mixed subscriber trends, right? Overall performance was relatively flat.
Yeah, countervailing forces at play.
Total revenue was up just slightly, 0.6% year over year, hitting $13.8 billion.
And the revenue mix tells the story.
Clearly. Growth was driven by that 24.9% surge in residential mobile revenue, plus a small 2.8% increase in residential internet revenue.
Okay, so mobile and internet up.
But that growth was almost entirely wiped out by a steep 9.9% decline in high-margin video revenue.
Ah, the mix shift challenge.
Yeah.
Lower-margin mobile replacing higher-margin video.
Exactly. That presents a challenge for overall profitability, doesn't it? This raises an important question. How sustainable is it to maintain margins when you're swapping high-margin revenue for lower-margin revenue like that? What's the long-term outlook if that shift continues?
It's a major challenge. In the short term, they seem to be managing it through cost control. Despite that difficult revenue mix, net income actually increased 5.7% to $1.3 billion.
And adjusted EBITDA
grew slightly, 0.5% to $5.7 billion. And crucially, they held the line on margins. The adjusted EBITDA margin stayed healthy at 41.4%, basically flat year over year.
Which is an achievement in itself, given the mix shift.
It's a notable operational achievement, yes. But the flat top line and EBITDA growth highlight that central financial challenge. Mobile growth isn't yet big enough to fully offset the legacy video declines and the broadband pressures.
So maintaining margins is good, but accelerating profit growth requires scaling those strategic initiatives faster. Or improving mobile margins over time.
Both, ideally. They need mobile to keep scaling rapidly, and they need initiatives like the CBRS build-out to eventually improve the profitability of that mobile segment. It's a race against the decline of legacy revenue streams.
Let's look at capital allocation and cash flow. Q2 was still about heavy investment, right?
Very much so. Capital expenditures were $2.9 billion for the quarter, roughly flat compared to last year.
And a big chunk of that was for the rural build-out.
Yeah, $1 billion specifically for those rural line extensions.
But they did update their guidance for the full year.
They did. Trimmed the full year 2025 CapEx forecast slightly from $12 billion down to about $11.5 billion.
I had to change.
They cited some shifts in the timing of the network evolution spending and also line extension costs coming in a bit lower than expected.
Okay, but what about free cash flow? That took a hit.
It did. Free cash flow decreased to $1.2 billion for the quarter, down from $1.3 billion the year before.
What drove the decline?
Primarily unfavorable changes in working capital, specifically related to financing all those mobile devices they're selling, plus just the timing of when cash tax and interest payments were made.
So it reinforces that point about how cash-intensive this current phase is. Mobile growth needs working capital for handsets, plus the huge CapEx program.
Exactly. It puts significant demands on cash generation right now. They did continue returning cash to shareholders, though, repurchasing 4.5 million shares for $1.7 billion.
But there's a potential positive on the horizon for cash flow, something about taxes.
Yes, a significant potential positive. Recent federal tax legislation restored some favorable rules, bonus depreciation, and interest deductibility. That's expected to create a substantial cash tax tailwind for Charter, maybe around $1 billion in 2026.
So like an unexpected billion-dollar boost to their cash.
Essentially, yes. Which provides crucial extra capital to help fund those big investments and support free cash flow during this heavy spending period. A welcome bit of relief.
Okay, let's put the balance sheet under the microscope. Leverage, debt, that's always key for capital-intensive companies like Charter.
Absolutely. They operate with significant debt, which is typical for the industry. As of Q1 2025, their long-term debt was around $92
billion. $92 billion. That's a big number. And current liabilities were also much higher than current assets.
Okay, let's unpack this. How does such a significant debt load impact their flexibility, especially right now during this period of heavy investment and intense market disruption?
It's a critical factor. While common in telecom, $92 billion in debt requires extremely disciplined financial management. It definitely impacts flexibility. How so?
Well, it limits their ability to react quickly to unexpected market shifts without taking on even more debt. It might constrain things like share buybacks or opportunistic acquisitions. And of course, a substantial chunk of their cash flow has to go towards servicing that debt-paying interest rather than being reinvested or returned to shareholders.
And the proposed Cox merger adds even more debt to the pile, right?
Materially impacts it, yes. The combined company is expected to assume about $12 billion of Cox's existing debt.
So pushing the total closer to, what, $104 billion initially?
In that ballpark, yes. Which is why management has been very clear about their post-merger leverage strategy.
What's the plan?
They're targeting a net debt-to-EBITDA ratio a key leverage metric in the range of 3.5x to 4.0x, and they plan to prioritize paying down debt to get to the midpoint of that range within 2 to 3 years after the merger closes.
So deleveraging is a key priority post-merger.
Absolutely. Showing the discipline will be crucial for investor confidence as they integrate Cox. It signals financial prudence during a complex period.
That brings us squarely to the transformative catalyst itself, the Cox Communications merger.
The biggest news of the year for Charter, arguably.
Announced May 16, 2025, a definitive agreement to acquire Cox Communications. This could genuinely reshape the entire U.S. broadband landscape.
It's a massive deal, valuing Cox at an enterprise value of around $34.5 billion.
Based on Charter's own trading multiple, right. And it's a complex structure. Cox's parent company, Cox Enterprises,
becomes a major shareholder in the new combined company, holding about a 23% stake.
Interesting. And the branding strategy is also notable. The combined company adopts the Cox Communications name within a year.
But they'll roll out Charter's Spectrum brand across the legacy Cox markets for products and services.
So corporate name Cox, consumer brand Spectrum everywhere. A bit unusual, maybe.
A bit, but it aims for unified product identity while perhaps leveraging the Cox corporate reputation.
Okay, the strategic rationale here seems multifaceted. What are the key drivers?
Several compelling reasons. First, just sheer scale and market leadership. This combination creates the undisputed largest broadband provider in the U.S.
Bigger than Comcast now.
Yes. Pro forma, we're talking 69.5 million homes and businesses passed, nearly 36 million broadband subscribers. That eclipses Comcast.
And that scale gives them leverage.
Significant leverage. In negotiations with TV programmers, with hardware vendors for equipment, maybe even with their MVNO partners, size matters in those talks.
Second rationale, footprint expansion.
Right. And crucially, it's geographic expansion into non-overlapping markets. Charter gets into key high-growth areas like Phoenix, Las Vegas, where they aren't present now.
Plus adjacent states like Virginia, Kansas, Oklahoma.
Well, exactly. Creates a more contiguous 46-state network. Should lead to operational efficiencies over time.
And perhaps the biggest strategic win, mobile.
This might be the most significant benefit, yes.
Yeah.
It creates a huge new territory to deploy that incredibly successful Spectrum mobile strategy.
Because Cox was behind on mobile.
Very much so. A late entrant. They only have about 200,000 mobile customers out of over 6 million relationships. That's a massive, untapped cross-selling opportunity for Charter to push the Spectrum One bundle into millions of new homes.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this merger isn't just about getting bigger for the sake of it. It's about acquiring specific assets that perfectly fueled Charter's existing transformation strategy, especially mobile.
Precisely. It's like finding the perfect undeveloped plot of land right next door, tailor-made for your most successful product. It provides the ideal platform to accelerate their number one growth initiative.
And then there are the expected synergies, right? Financial and operational.
Yes. Cost savings from eliminating duplicate corporate overhead, economies of scale in marketing, programming deals, equipment purchasing,
and revenue synergies
from aggressively cross-selling Spectrum Mobile, deploying Charter's pricing and packaging across the Cox footprint, plus migrating Cox's existing mobile customers over to Charter's potentially more favorable MVNO deal should improve mobile margins.
So the creation of this much larger entity, what does it mean for the competitive dynamics in U.S. telecom?
It has profound implications. It really solidifies the cable industry's position against those big rivals, the telcos like AT&T and Verizon with their fiber, and the wireless giants like T-Mobile pushing FWA.
Creates a clearer cable duopoly at the top.
Effectively, yes. The newly enlarged Charter, soon to be Cox corporate name, and Comcast will control a substantial majority of the U.S. cable and broadband market.
Could that lead to less intense competition between those two?
It's possible. While they'll still compete fiercely, that level of market concentration could lead to a somewhat more rational competitive environment between the two giants, perhaps focusing competition more against fiber and FWA.
So the merger feels both defensive and offensive.
I think that's a great way to frame it. Defensive. It gives them the scale and financial muscle to better withstand the onslaught from fiber and FWA. Offensive. It provides that large, fertile new territory in the Cox footprint, massively underpenetrated in mobile, offering a clear path to accelerate their biggest growth driver.
It's not just about size. It's about acquiring the right assets to fuel their strategy.
Exactly. Acquiring the ideal platform for their most promising initiative.
But of course, a merger this big doesn't come without risks. Success hinges on realizing those synergies and managing the integration.
Absolutely. The execution risk is substantial. On the synergy side, beyond cost and revenue, there are potential long-term network efficiencies too. Cox apparently completed a mid-split upgrade on much of its network.
What does that mean?
It enhances upload speeds, kind of a step towards DOCSIS 4.0. It means the eventual cost for the combined company to upgrade the COPS footprint fully to DOCSIS 4.0 might be lower, and they can maybe do it on a more deliberate timeline.
Okay, but the integration risks must be huge. Here's where it gets really interesting. How do they manage this massive integration while also dealing with peak CapEx and the most intense competition ever? That sounds like a tightrope walk.
It's a monumental task. You're merging two large, complex organizations, different corporate cultures, different IT systems, different ways of doing things.
Missteps could be costly.
Very costly. Customer service disruptions, key employees leaving, failure to actually capture those projected synergies. All real risks.
Plus, the regulatory angle isn't completely closed.
Right. While approval is expected, the FCC could still impose conditions, operational or financial, that might reduce the deal's value proposition somewhat.
And just the sheer strain on management.
Enormous. Overseeing this integration while navigating peak spending and fighting intense competition on multiple fronts. It puts immense pressure on their ability to execute flawlessly. It's arguably the biggest execution challenge you've ever faced.
How do you think they approach that, balancing integration with everything else?
They'll need incredibly clear priorities, probably a dedicated high-level integration team insulated as much as possible from the day-to-day operations to minimize disruption. They'll have to be surgical about what gets integrated first, maybe tackling things with quick synergy payoffs like mobile migration, but for the deep, complex stuff like unifying all the network management system.
Communication must be key too.
Paramount. Internally, with employees from both companies, externally with customers, and certainly with investors to manage expectations. It requires focus and discipline at an extraordinary level.
Okay, let's broaden the view again and look at the competitive arena, benchmark Charter against its peer.
Context is crucial.
Their most direct competitor has to be Comcast, right? CMCSA.
Absolutely. Very similar business model, HFC network core, facing almost identical strategic challenges.
Before the Cox deal, they were roughly similar in size. Post-merger, Charter, as Cox, becomes clearly larger in broadband subs.
Yeah, that pro forma 35.9 million for Charter Cox versus Comcast's 32.2 million.
And they're pursuing almost identical strategies, too, with the MVNO convergence play.
Nearly identical playbooks, yes. Both have also been losing broadband subs recently, though Comcast's losses have been a bit steeper. Maybe suggest Charter's execution has been slightly better lately.
Perhaps. Then you have the telco challengers, AT&T and Verizon.
Your big incumbents. Primary wireline and wireless competition.
Their main weapon on the wireline side is fiber, right? Extensive, expanding fiber networks.
Definitely. AT&T Fiber, especially, is a market leader. Ranks high in satisfaction, expanding aggressively, over 30 million locations passed. That's direct pressure on Charter's broadband base.
And both AT&T and Verizon are hitting Charter with FWA, too.
Leveraging their huge 5G wireless networks to compete for home internet customers. And those FWA products have been surprisingly popular and well-rated, as we discussed.
And unlike the cable guys, AT&T and Verizon are super diversified, right? Their mobile businesses are the main profit center.
Yes.
Tying with fiber on satisfaction. That's incredible.
It really is. And the rapid growth of T-Mobile's FWA has been a primary driver of the pressure and sub-losses for Charter and the whole cable industry.
Which creates that weird frenemy dynamic you mentioned.
Exactly. Because Charter recently signed a deal to use T-Mobile's network for its business mobile services. So they're partners on one hand and fierce competitors for home internet customers on the other. A complex relationship.
Okay, let's try to quantify some of this with pure valuation multiples and capital efficiency. Comparing the financials can give us some insight into how the market views them.
Right, let's look at table one valuation multiples. We have EV revenue, EV/EBITDA, PE ratios.
Okay, for Charter, CHTR, market cap around $52.08, enterprise value $156.06. Gives an EV revenue of 2.8x, estimated EBITDA maybe 7.0x, and PE around 9.0x estimated.
How does that stack up? Compared to Comcast, CMCSA, market cap $124.09, EV $215.03, lower multiples there. EV revenue 1.8x, EBITDA 5.6x, PE around 10.0x.
Interesting. Lower EV multiples for Comcast. What about the telcos? AT&T, Market share 197 Vs, EV $334.07, EV revenue 2.9x, EBITDA 7.9x, PE higher at 16.8x.
And Verizon, VZ, market cap $179.01 Bs, EV $345.05, EV revenue 2.6x, EV EBITDA 7.0x, very similar to Charter and PE, about 10.1x.
Okay, and T-Mobile, TMUS, the disruptor, market cap $258.99 and PE way up at 22.7x.
So what story do these numbers tell? How is the market valuing their growth, profitability, risk?
Well, T-Mobile's high multiples clearly screen growth. The market expects strong performance, likely fueled by mobile leadership and FWA success. Comcast's lower EV multiples might reflect concerns about its legacy media assets dragging things down or slower core growth.
While AT&T and Verizon are somewhere in between, maybe reflecting their scale but slower overall growth profiles.
Seems plausible. And Charter, being valued similarly to Verizon on EBITDA, suggests the market sees the transformation potential, but maybe still holds some caution given the broadband challenges and the execution risks ahead.
Okay, now let's look at table two, capital efficiency. This compares return on invested capital, ROIC, versus the weighted average cost of capital, WACC. Remember, ROIC, WACC means you're creating economic value.
Right, so for Charter, CHTR, ROIC is 7.11%, WACC is 6.62%. That gives a positive spread of plus 0.49%, so creating some value.
Modest value creation, how does that compare? Comcast, CMCSA, shows an ROIC of 8.49%. Verizon VZ has ROIC 5.99%, WACC 4.95%, giving a healthier spread of plus 1.04%. T-Mobile, TMUS, has an ROIC of 6.79%.
So Charter spread is positive but slim, similar ROIC to T-Mobile, but lagging Comcast and Verizon's spread. What's fascinating here is how these metrics show where value is really being created, especially with Charter deploying billions in new capital. We connect this to the bigger picture. Why is capital efficiency just so critical for long-term value in this industry?
It's paramount, because telecom is incredibly capital-intensive, as we've said. They're constantly pouring money into networks, upgrades, expansion, new tech like 5G. If those billions being invested don't generate returns above the cost of borrowing or raising that capital, the WACC, then you're actually destroying shareholder value, even if revenues are growing.
So a positive ROIC WACC spread is proof the investments are actually worthwhile financially.
Exactly. It signals sustainable profitability, efficient use of resources, and ultimately a stronger competitive position long term. It's the financial report card on management's investment decisions. Charter's positive spread is good, but improving it as they deploy this peak CapEx will be key for investors.
Okay, let's pull it all together now, a concluding analysis. What are the key factors for Charter's future performance? Let's synthesize the strengths and vulnerabilities.
All right, strengths first. They have that extensive, high-quality HFC network with a clear upgrade path via WCSE-SI 4.0 to match fiber speeds. That's a core asset.
Plus, the proven mobile growth engine Spectrum Mobile. Fastest growing, now cash flow positive, great retention tool.
The enhanced scale post-Cox merger is another huge strength. Becoming the largest broadband provider brings significant advantages.
And experience management. Winfrey and his team have a track record of operations and integrating large acquisitions.
Definitely strengths. But the vulnerabilities are significant too.
Top of the list. Those challenged broadband subscriber trends. The core high-margin business is losing customers due to intense competition.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the secular decline in legacy video. Even stabilized, it's a long-term drag on high-margin revenue.
The intensifying competitive environment, battling fiber on tech, battling FWA on price and value, fighting a war on two fronts.
And finally, the high leverage and capital intensity. Significant debt plus a peak investment cycle consumes cash, reduces flexibility, and amplifies risk if things go wrong.
So what does this all mean for the overall health and future path of Charter? It's a company with strong assets and a proven growth engine, but facing serious headwinds and undertaking massive, risky transformations.
It really highlights how critical execution will be over the next few years. They have a path forward, but the margin for error is slim.
Which brings us to the critical success factors. What absolutely has to go right for Charter to create long-term value?
Okay, number one, without a doubt, successful integration of Cox Communications. This is the immediate, massive catalyst.
Get the synergies, launch mobile effectively in those new markets, make the deal rationale work. Failure here would be a major setback.
Absolute paramount. Second, returning the broadband segment to growth. This is the ultimate litmus test.
Can that Spectrum One bundle, powered by mobile and maybe stabilized video, actually stop the bleeding and start attracting net new internet customers again?
If broadband keeps shrinking long term, the whole investment thesis gets undermined. It has to turn around.
Third critical factor.
Disciplined navigation of this peak CapEx cycle. They have to execute the DOCSIS 4.0 upgrade and the rural build-out on time and on budget.
The market expects 2025 to be the peak spending year, right? After that, CapEx should decline, hopefully freeing up significant cash flow.
That's the expectation. Meeting those timelines and budgets is crucial for credibility and hitting future cash flow targets.
And finally,
maintaining pricing discipline and growing ARPU average revenue per user. In this increasingly commoditized market, they have to hold the line on pricing as much as possible.
To offset inflation, fund investments, protect margins.
Right. But the intense competition, especially from lower-priced FWA, is going to test that discipline severely. Can they command premium pricing with their bundle?
Okay, those are four huge factors. This raises an important question. Which of those critical success factors do you think presents the biggest hurdle for Charter, and why?
That's a tough one. They're all critical.
Yeah.
The Cox integration is huge and complex. CapEx execution requires immense operational skill. Pricing is tough in this market.
Yeah.
I think I have to agree with your earlier point. Returning the broadband segment to growth feels like the biggest hurdle, fundamentally.
Why that one specifically?
Because the integration and CapEx, while challenging, are more within their direct control. It's about project management and execution. Reversing broadband losses means fighting external market forces, intense competition from fiber and FWA, changing consumer behavior, commoditization pressures. It requires convincing customers their bundle offers superior value in a crowded, noisy market.
It's less about engineering a network and more about winning hearts and minds and wallets against very tough competitors.
Exactly. It strikes at the core of their business value proposition in a way the other factors, while critical, don't quite match. Success there validates the entire convergence strategy. Failure there makes everything else much harder.
Yeah, I land there too. It feels like the most existential challenge among the four. Okay, what an incredible journey we've taken through this complex world of telecom, and specifically how Charter Communications is trying to transform itself.
It's a case study in adaptation, that's for sure.
It really highlights that big idea we started with. Constant transformation, strategic adaptation being essential in the face of relentless disruption. Cord cutting, the fiber future, the sudden rise of 5G FWA, it never stops.
A truly dynamic landscape, never a dull moment for these companies.
So here's a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. Given the sheer scale of investment needed, the intensity of competition coming from every angle, fiber, wireless, other cable guys, and the constant shifts in what we as consumers want. Will this industry ever really settle into a predictable future?
Or is constant radical transformation just the new normal now for telecom?
And maybe more importantly, what does all this ongoing upheaval mean for you, trying to navigate your own choices for internet, for mobile, in this ever-changing landscape? Are you getting better deals, more confusion, both?
Something to ponder next time your Wi-Fi flickers, perhaps.
Absolutely. Think about that. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll be back soon with more insights.